And so as mentioned when we started this study, most of the classes are only going to be two sessions long. We look at the Old Testament, we look at the New Testament. But I really wanted to spend a little bit of extra time on Jesus as the high priest, because there's just a lot of practical applications that we can see when we look into the life of Jesus as the high priest. And really, this lesson is a combination of a few different sermons, one of which was first presented to me, of this idea of why did Jesus suffer on the cross? And at first, I was like, oh, easy question. Great. This will be a 30-second sermon, and we'll be done. But it wasn't quite that easy. Because we know that Jesus had to die on the cross, or had to die, period, so that we could have his blood for the removal of sins. But that doesn't answer the question of why did Jesus suffer. And so I want you to be thinking about that as we go through. And a little bit of a spoiler alert, but it goes back to this idea of the fact that he is the high priest. And I think it's critical for us to see that. So let's go and take a look at Jesus as the high priest. We're going to look at Hebrews chapter 4, verses 15 through 16. And just for context here, looking at the book of Hebrews, again, the book of Hebrews is that Jesus is greater than the old law. It talks about him being greater than the angels, greater than Moses. And then it spends a lot of time talking about him being the greater high priest, the greater priest. And if you'll remember, he gets into this at the beginning, or here in chapter 4. At the end of chapter 4, he goes into the introduction of Jesus as the high priest. Then he takes a second, gets onto them, and says, you guys really don't get it. So now I'm going to have to back up even further. And then spends a bunch of time talking about Jesus as the high priest. And so we see chapters 7, 8, 9, 10 all go into this idea of Jesus as the high priest. But notice the introduction to it here in chapter 4, verses 14 through 15. So if you'll read that for us.
Verses 14 through 16, you said?
Yeah, that works.
Hebrews chapter 4, starting verse 14. Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then, with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need.
Perfect. Thank you. And yeah, again, we're going to be passing around the mic. Go ahead and pass it on if you're not comfortable reading. But again, I appreciate everybody's help in reading these passages. But notice the claim that is made here about Jesus as a high priest. The claim is that Jesus can sympathize with us. So when we're going through the difficulties of life, when we go through trials, when we go through temptations, Jesus knows what that feels like. He can sympathize with you. He can say, look, this is hard for them. And I know that because I went through it. And the question that we need to ask ourselves is, do you believe that claim? Do you believe that Jesus actually does sympathize with you? That he knows what it feels like to go through those things? And then also with that, do you believe that there is the grace that is talked about in here as well? That grace comes through and allows us to be before God, to allows us to overcome temptation, to be holy in the sight of the Lord. Do we believe those things? And I think it's very important for us to sometimes go back and look at things in the scriptures and ask ourselves, do we understand this? Because there's a lot of times that things are held that at first might even seem in contradiction. the idea of God being all-loving, but also full of judgment. How do those two things work together? And if we're not careful, we can go one side or the other too much. And so when we look at Jesus and this idea of him being all man, it can be hard for us to understand. He's all God and all man. And to be frank, it's very difficult for us to understand even our own makeup. We live our experience every day. How are we both spirit and flesh? And yet, somehow, God tells us that we are. But it's confusing to me to understand how both those things are. How the fact that what I ate for breakfast can make a difference in how I feel in a temptation later that day. How does that all work together? I don't fully understand it. But I know the scriptures talk about it. And so we need to understand that part of the scriptures and understand, again, this idea of Jesus being all man. So again, there's just these two ideas here. I mentioned it at the very beginning, but forgiveness for when we do fall short, that's part of the grace. But the second part of the grace is the grace to withstand temptation. Let's take a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 through 9. So we see here that Paul has a very specific trial, a very specific difficulty that is causing him a problem. And he's asking for that situation to be changed. And God says, no, the situation does not have to be changed. My grace is enough to get you to the other side. No matter what you're going through, my grace can allow you to succeed and remain faithful while succeeding. Not only can you get through this thing, but you can remain faithful to me. That's what my grace can do for you. And so, again, when we look at this idea of believing that Jesus was man, but also in this idea of believing in the grace, do we believe that God's grace forgives, but also that God's grace allows us to overcome? So, to start with, let's just take a look and see what the scriptures have to say about Jesus the man. There's only a couple of things here that we're going to look at this morning for time's sake. But it is interesting to me what we see about Jesus. So, first of all, there was a need for him to learn and grow. Let's take a look at Luke chapter 2, 41 through 52.
Subject to them, and and his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus kept increasing wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men.
All right, so at first glance, this might be an interesting decision to talk about the fact that Jesus was a man, because at the same time, it points to something special about him because of some of the things you see him doing, the way he's acting, and even the way he's talking is impressive. But notice the idea here as Jesus is talking to these people. It's as someone asking questions. He's learning at their feet. He's listening to what they have to say. If you compare this to Luke 4:14 through 20, this has been after another 18 years. So Jesus doesn't start his ministry at age 12 after this impressive performance at the temple. He doesn't start it when he turns 16. He doesn't start it when he turns 18. He doesn't start it when he turns 21. He waits until the age of 30. At the age of 30, he goes through some things, and we get to this first sermon in Luke chapter 4. And it is full of authority. It might remind you of the Sermon on the Mount, where people were surprised that he taught so much differently than everybody else. And when Jesus teaches with authority in this way, he immediately, because he's doing it in his hometown, he makes everybody mad at him. Like, who do you think you are? So, again, there is this process that winds up happening where Jesus is growing, he's learning, and it's really even emphasized in chapter 2, verse 52, when it talks about how he continued to grow in wisdom and in stature. So again, this is not easy stuff. I get it. How does the Son of God grow in wisdom? I can't fully answer that for you, but I know that the scriptures say that he does. And so there is this part of him being a man, being in the flesh and dealing with the fleshly weaknesses that we all do, that we see even from the very beginning. Another example of this is the fact that Jesus needed time in prayer. I find this fascinating. So you take a look at Mark chapter 1, verse 35. Let's go ahead and read that real quick.
In the early morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, went away to a secluded place, and was praying there.
Okay, so from the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, he takes time to pray. Now again, if anybody wanted an excuse not to wake up early and pray, it would be Jesus. He was up late the night before, but not because he was binging his TV show. He was up late the night before because he was healing people and he was teaching them the gospel. But Jesus took time to pray consistently. And we're going to spend some time in the garden a little bit later, so we're not going to read this right now. But one of the things that he goes to Peter, and he says, Peter, you need to make sure that you're praying right now. Why? Because your spirit is willing. I know who you are. Satan has asked for you to tempt you. Your spirit is willing. You said that earlier, but your flesh is weak. And then Jesus goes and does the same thing. He goes and prays. Even though the disciples go to sleep, Jesus goes and prays. Why? Because his flesh is weak too. And so I think in this reliance on prayer, Jesus continually coming to God in prayer is also a sign of, again, him being in the flesh and struggling with the flesh. So we're about to go in and talk a little bit more about the temptations. But before we do that, why is it so important to establish the earthly nature of Jesus, the fact that he did come in the flesh and experience the flesh like we do? Yeah, that is a question.
Because he is not separated from our suffering. He joined us in our suffering.
Yeah, exactly. He is not separated from it. He joined us in that suffering. So, you know, there's kind of three truths we see in the Bible, and I'm picking these three because we're talking about them. But we see the fact that Jesus is man. We see the fact that Jesus is God. And we see that Jesus never sins. And it's possible for us to take two of those three things, the fact that he is God and the fact that he never sins, and say, was it really a temptation? Did he really struggle with these things? And I think that's a mistake that we can make. And as we go through and we talk about these temptations, do not diminish them because he was also God in the flesh. Yeah, Eric.
So in regard to that, going back to Jesus' ruling wisdom and stature, if you take a look at what the meaning of those words are, wisdom is really applied knowledge. We talk about it that way a lot. But if you think about what Jesus was doing when he learned wisdom, he was applying God's knowledge to human weakness, which he had never had before. So there is a learning there because he never had human weakness before. Now he does. He's applying knowledge to it. He's gaining wisdom. So you can actually look at it that way. And the stature actually grows out of that because he becomes a man.
Right.
His stature as a man grows. So he's learning wisdom and growing in stature. And that's actually what it's saying. He's becoming human.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Kelly?
Well, and apart from that, too, Jesus came as a human being. I think one of the most impactful things about the gospel message should be for us is his compassion he showed us as a human being. God seems a little abstract to us. He's not abstract. He loves us in the same way Jesus did.
Right.
But it was harder for us to conceptualize that. But when we see the creator of the universe touch a leper and say, I am willing, be healed, well, that resonates with us. It should.
Right. Yes, exactly.
It's like, this is no, the creator came here.
Right. Yeah, and to that point, you know, we've talked about the two classifications of the high priest. He is man's representative to God, which he can do because he does struggle as a man, but he's also God's representative to man. So he shows us God, again, not in the abstract, but in the anchored reality of the flesh. All right, so with that in mind then, go ahead, Billy. Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. God wouldn't do that.
Right.
So some of us see this as good news. Some of us see this as ludicrous news.
Yeah. And in fact, you see that the gospel comes and almost immediately the false doctrine of him not coming in the flesh, it follows right in its footsteps to where John has to say, look, if you are denying this, and you kind of see it in the word became flesh, but if you are denying this, you are being the Antichrist. This is a very difficult concept for us to grasp, again, to hold both sides in our mind at the same time. So we need to be understanding of that difficulty as we go through. Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
I'm sorry. I thought it was worth noting that concept of propitiation, which there's been debate over how to translate it, because with an outsider view, this idea of a God, let's go to the high priest, a God, you have to appease a God.
Right.
And it had a very negative connotation. It had an infantile connotation to it. But the beautiful, I think he turns the table and it's supposed to be powerful. That's right. You couldn't offer anything to me.
Right.
So what do I do? Well, if you're unlike your other gods, you're out of luck.
Right.
But instead, I take your flesh and your blood, I come as one of you, and I offer myself to myself.
Right.
Instead of throwing you to the wayside.
Yeah.
You understand that, and so then it owns the term propitiation, and God doesn't run from it. He goes, no, let's use that term. It's just that I'll be doing the work. Oh, wow.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And again, what Sean was saying was the idea of the propitiation at that time was used in other religions, and those religions was basically nothing was sufficient, and so the gods were unloving about it. And so we see the contrast of Jesus being loving. Yes. Yeah, I just repeated it though, that the gods were that Jesus is in contrast to the gods of the time. And so when he uses that term propitiation, that's putting a contrast between the false gods who would never be loving enough to accept the sacrifice of mankind, and Jesus, who not only was willing to accept that offering, he was willing to become the offering. So again, the idea of Jesus coming in the flesh is such an act of incredible love for us. All right, so with that being established, I want to talk about the temptation of Christ. He is man, and so when we go into these temptations, again, we need to understand that this is appealing to him on this earthly, fleshly level. So let's read Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. All right, so we see here, right at the beginning of his ministry, Jesus is tempted by Satan. He goes, he spends some time for himself, spends 40 days fasting, he's preparing himself. You know, again, he's putting away the fleshly by doing this fasting, and he's spending this time praying. And so Satan comes to him and he offers him three different temptations. He says, turn the stones into bread. There's these stones here. I know you're hungry. You haven't been eating for 40 days. Turn those stones into bread. The next one is throw yourself from the pinnacle of the temple. And, you know, it's going to be fine. You know, and really, well, we'll talk about that more in a second. But again, throw yourself from the pinnacle of the temple. And then finally, bow down and worship me. Now, it is something that can happen where we read these, and Jesus is tempted three times here, and he turns all of them down, and we may make the mistake of thinking that's all the temptation that happened. We're not going to read it right now, but Luke's account of this, it says Satan went away waiting for a more opportune time. This is not the only temptation that Jesus encountered. But we're going to show specifically how it actually culminates in this time on the cross that he has these temptations right in his face once again. But let's talk about why these are temptations. So the idea of turning stones into bread, This is not something that's going to be difficult for Jesus to accomplish. In Matthew chapter 16, his disciples are, talking about this idea of Jesus says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. And his disciples are, is he upset that we didn't get bread? And he's like, guys, it's not about bread. Look at all these things I've done. When there were 4,000 people, I fed them. When there were 5,000 people, I fed them. No problem. This miracle was not hard. What Satan is asking Jesus to do is not hard. And in fact, Jesus could have done this at any time. I was thinking about on the drive here this morning. I was like, you know what? This is the easiest form of DoorDash ever. Jesus could have made this happen and boom, it's right there. However, one of the things that is understood, both in the way Satan is tempting him, but also what we see throughout the scriptures, is that it's wrong to use the power of God for selfish gain. When God gave his prophets and his apostles and Jesus the power to do miracles, it was not so that they could benefit themselves. In Acts chapter 8, we see Simon, the sorcerer, he sees the apostles come and he's like, yeah, everybody's going to go follow these guys because what they're doing is much greater than what I'm doing. So he goes and say, hey, look, how much would it cost for you to lay your hands on me so that I can do these miracles as well? And they are like, are you kidding me? This is not something that is a money-making venture. This is meant to proclaim the power of God. Using it for yourself is wrong. It is selfish. It is abhorrent to God. And you need to be careful because your soul is in jeopardy for even suggesting such a thing, even as a Christian. Okay? So that idea, take that back to where Jesus is now. Jesus isn't confirming the word of God for anybody here. Not like he does when he makes food for 5,000 people. He's not explaining some greater purpose for God. He would only be doing this because his flesh was hungry. That's not okay. That's not what this gift was meant for. And so you see that Satan is tempting him to use the power to help himself. In fact, going back to our idea of God and man, he's tempting him to use the power to make it to where temptation is not as hard for him, where the earthly body is not as hard for him. He also says, throw yourself off of the pinnacle. Here we see this thing of proving who you are. If you throw yourself off of this pinnacle, then the angels will come, they will rescue you, and now I and everybody else will know that you are the Son of God. It's an appeal to Jesus's pride. And then we also see this idea of bowing down and worship me. Now, there's a lot we're not told about God and Jesus at this time. I don't know what Satan understood about God's plan. Seems like he doesn't have the full picture. Otherwise, he wouldn't have walked straight into it. But regardless, whatever the case is, he says, bow down and worship me, and you can be king over everything. And whatever Satan meant by that as a temptation, I can tell you what it was for Jesus. It was a way for him to not have to go through the next 3 years culminating in the cross and to be the king over all the world. And so there is a way that you can be the ruler without sacrifice. You can take the easy way out. We see that this temptation not only happens multiple times throughout the Gospels, but in particular is seen at the cross. So in Matthew chapter 27, verses 26 through 35, for time's sake, we're not going to read all of that. But just remember what it is that Jesus goes through on the day that he's crucified. It's not just the crucifixion, which, by the way, the word excruciating comes up with that. The pain of the cross was so bad that they had to make a new word to describe the level of pain. But before that even happens, the soldiers take him and they scourge him. He is a crown of thorns. He has a crown of thorns. And again, not just a small little crown, like big thorns placed on his head. He's beaten with a reed. And then he's told to carry his cross. and he can't do it. He stumbles. His flesh is so weak from what is happening that he stumbles on it. And the temptation here would be, again, to use his power to make this not so bad. Now, there's a lot of ways he could have done that. One was calling the angels and have it not happen at all. But look, a couple weeks ago, you guys saw me limping around. I had hurt my ankle. It was bothering me a lot more than any other ankle sprain or foot sprain I had ever had. So I go to the doctor, and the doctor says, "Do you want an injection for that?" And I'm like, "You know what? Sure, that sounds like a good thing." You're telling me the creator of the universe couldn't have done something for his pain during this time? He couldn't have created extra blood cells so there wasn't blood loss? Like, he could have done all of these things to make it easier on himself, to take the power of God and to make it to where this was not so bad. That's what Satan was offering him when he said, "Turn the stones into bread." At the cross, we're talking about an even bigger form of deprivation, pain, earthly weakness. And Jesus does not give in and use his power to make it easier. We also have the idea of appeal to pride. So let's take a look at Matthew chapter 27, verses 40 through 43. We will go ahead and read this one. Okay, so they repeat Jesus' claims that he made previously. They are missing the point that Jesus could stop this at any moment, that angels could come. That's what Jesus, says repeatedly, like, "Look, Pilate, just so you know, you think you're in charge of this? You think I'm dying because you decided it? I could stop this at any time. I'm letting this happen." It's one thing to do that, knowing all the pain and all the difficulty. It's another when the people you're dying for are so ungrateful and they're appealing to your pride and saying, "Look, you couldn't do this." People telling me I can't do something, that's a trigger for me. Jesus does not take the bait. Instead, he refuses to fulfill their request. He stands strong and goes through with the sacrifice, even though he could have came down and it would have been the most terrifying things those people had ever seen. It's kind of interesting when people challenge Jesus, say, "Do more signs." Like, they don't realize that in the New Testament, we call them miracles. In the Old Testament, we call them plagues. Jesus could have shown them all the signs they ever wanted to see. He doesn't, because he's on a different mission. And then also, again, the idea of the easy path. Jesus knew how bad things are about to be. Let's take a look at Matthew chapter 26, 36 through 44. If somebody can read that for us.
"Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane, and said to the disciples, 'Sit here while I go and pray over there.' And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, 'My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me.' He went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not I will, but as you will.' And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping, and said to Peter, 'What, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.' Again, a second time he went away and prayed, saying, 'O my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done.' And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. So he left them went away again and prayed a third time, saying the same words.
So we see here, Jesus understands what's about to be happening, and he is sorrowful unto the point of death. And other passages talk about him having tears and sweat as blood. This is intense. Jesus is overwhelmed. He's struggling. And he says, let this cup pass from me. And you know, Satan is there whispering in his ear, I have a way. And this explains why in Matthew chapter 16. So Matthew chapter 16, you have this amazing pronouncement from Peter saying that you are the Christ. And Jesus says, yes, and upon this rock I will build my church. Then Jesus starts to tell them, hey, I'm going to die. And Peter says, no, it will never happen. Jesus knew then what was going to happen. And what does he tell Peter? Oh, you silly goose. It's no big deal. You just misunderstand the kingdom. No. He says, you get behind me, Satan. The world is telling me I don't have to do this. Satan is telling me I don't have to do this. I don't need you telling me I don't have to do this. Jesus had this temptation. And so let's take a look back at Hebrews chapter 4. We're going to start in 14 again, but this time we're going to read through 5:10. Sorry, Hebrews chapter 4, verses 14, and then we're going to go into chapter 5 and go to verse 10.
Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, the one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. For every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God, in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness. And because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins, as for the people, so also for himself. And no one takes the honor to himself, receives it when he is called by God, even as Aaron was. So also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest, but he who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you, just as he was also. He says also in another passage, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. In the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to him. And he was heard because of his piety. Also, he was a son. He learned about obedience from the things which he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation, being designated by God as a high priest, according to the order of Melchizedek.
So why did Jesus suffer on the cross? When you look at Old Testament sacrifices, they weren't made to suffer for days. In fact, if all that was needed was blood was shed right after Adam sinned, couldn't Jesus have just been created as a man and offered as a sacrifice? Blood was shed. Now everybody has forgiveness of sins. God didn't do that way. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And I don't want to just make it a scene that this is the only reason for that. But this is a big reason why. Jesus came and he was tempted like we were tempted. He prayed with loud cries and tears, and he learned obedience through suffering. Just like James tells us at the beginning of his letter, that we too learn patience, obedience, endurance through our suffering. So, when you are going through trials, when you are going through temptations, and you are at the point of tears because you don't know how you can take the next step, when you are struggling and you have well-meaning friends, well-meaning brothers and sisters in Christ who maybe thought you thought they would be there, they thought they would be there, but for whatever reason, their human failings made it to where you went through it all alone. Jesus has been there. Jesus has felt that, he has done that, and he knows how you feel. So he can sympathize as we can. And so it's very important for us as we're going through temptations to make sure we don't minimize what Jesus did, what he went through. Because sometimes we feel like no one could understand the level of temptation I'm going through right now. This is bad. I am hurting. I am crying. I am overwhelmed. No one could understand. We have a high priest who does. Jesus understands. Yeah, Billy.
So we think about John in 1 John 2, kind of breaks these things down into the desire of the flesh, the desire of the eye, and the pride of life, kind of categorizes these things. We can almost see in that first temptation of Christ, beginning of ministry, boom, boom, boom. But then also, when we think a little bit, like you're calling on us to do, about anything you can think of, the level, I heard somebody say one time, there's a reason that most of us don't go through what Job went through.
Right.
We don't have the faith in Job. God doesn't allow us to be tempted in a way that we can't overcome. You can't handle that.
Right.
Jesus, on the other hand, you know, doesn't eat for 40 days. Most of us can't make it past lunch. That's the level that Satan has to go to get Jesus.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, oh, I really wish I had a new car. I wish I had a new house. It's, here's all the kingdoms of the world and all their riches that you can have. And he still says no. Throwing himself down from the pinnacle, there's a pride to that as well. You are the Son of God, right? If you're the Son of God, prove it. I mean, we're not anybody. And like you, I mean, it's really important to think about this because it helps us so much to know, hey, it could be worse.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, like, if I'm honest and I think about it, when was the last time I resisted a temptation to the point of blood and sweat as tears? And the truth is normally I don't. There's a lot of times where I'll give in to temptation way before that. And so sometimes we think, man, this would just be too hard to do. And we need to understand that Jesus as a high priest shows us something else. He shows us the holiness of God. But if he went through all of that, if he's gone through more than we've ever gone through, and he stayed pure, what does that mean for us? See, the high priest had a problem, and it's something that the leaders here at North Collin, when you hear Sean, Billy, and Rod talk about things, they say, go and sin no more, and yet they are sinful people. When Jesus said, go and sin no more, he says, and I will show you how not to sin anymore. We need to understand that Jesus, as the high priest, doesn't just give us redemption of sins. When God talks about the fact that we can be made holy, it's not just, okay, sins are no longer seen. That's part of it. But it's also that you can be made holy and that you can overcome. 1 Corinthians 10:13, we see a promise here of, and I'll get you in just a second, Eric, but we see a promise here that when there's a temptation, a way of escape is made. Do you believe that is true? Or do you believe, no, there's no way I could do this? And it goes back to Jesus. If you think that the only reason Jesus endured his temptation is because he was God, you're missing what he went through. He showed the way. So we know there is no temptation that cannot be overcome. It's just a matter of if we're willing to follow in those footsteps. Go ahead, Eric.
Addressing your last point about suffering, I was thinking about the phrase that was used in the Gospels. It was, "Well, God proclaimed him begotten." Now you can say, "Today I have begotten you." The translation of that from Psalms 2:7 actually doesn't have to do with begetting. It's actually, "You are my son, today I proclaim you my son." So I think what that actually shows, if you think about that passage, is that he knew the suffering was coming, and this was the final pledge of allegiance.
Right.
"I will accept the mission." And God was actually supernaturally saying, "I see that you accept the mission. You are proclaimed my son." So he knew it was coming. I think that actually shows.
Yeah, 100%. And that, you know, it's one thing, it's just one thing to suffer knowing you could stop it. Like, going through the cross would be a hard enough temptation for me. But if the government decided to crucify me today, I can't stop it. Jesus could have stopped it, and he still did it. It just shows the level that he was willing to go to. All right, any other thoughts or comments before we finish? All right, next week we'll be talking about Jesus as the King. Thank you guys for your time and your attention.